As pregnant women and individuals are already toughing out a lot.
After the president told pregnant women to avoid Tylenol, what advice is an OBGYN giving her patients?
For Thursday, September 25th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, Amazon agrees to pay more than $2 billion in a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission.
Also, Mississippi has declared an infant mortality crisis. We'll look at the proposed solutions.
If having babies dying at the rate that our babies are dying is not a public health emergency, I don't know what is.
And what are the practical consequences of countries recognizing Palestinian statehood?
There's many ways that the international community can act rather than distracting us in this moment and not offering Palestinians the liberation that they deserve.
Plus, this week's Billboard charts remind us rock and roll isn't dead.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump has signed an executive order saying video sharing app TikTok can continue operating in the U.S. President Biden signed a bill last year calling for TikTok's Chinese owner, ByteDance, to sell its assets or face a nationwide ban. Trump's order declares that a proposed deal to sell the company meets national security concerns laid out by the law. Much is still unknown about the actual arrangement, but Trump said Chinese President Xi Jinping, quote, gave us the go-ahead to proceed with the deal. 5 days before federal agencies run out of money, a Trump administration memo threatening mass layoffs is increasing the prospects of a shutdown. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports.
The Office of Management and Budget released a memo indicating if the government shuts down next week, it will fire some federal workers instead of putting them on unpaid leave. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says OMB has already been engaging in what he called mass firings throughout the year, and Democrats will continue to pursue legal challenges. His message to OMB Chief Russ Vogt was get lost.
We will not be intimidated by these threats coming from the most extreme parts of the Trump administration.
President Trump called Democrats' demands to address health care costs as part of a funding deal unserious and says they will be blamed for a shutdown. There are no talks and no clear path to avoid a shutdown that could start October 1st. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, The Capitol.
Federal officials have identified the man who shot and killed a detainee and injured two others at an ICE facility in Dallas yesterday as 29-year-old Joshua Yan. Authorities say he acted alone and left detailed notes stating he had intended to shoot and terrorize ICE agents. He died of an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound. The head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, delivered a short address by video to the United Nations General Assembly today. The U.S. denied visas to the Palestinian leader about 80 other members of his government, meaning he could not give his address in person. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
Abbas applauded France, the UK, and other Western countries' symbolic recognition of the state of Palestine. And he criticized Jewish settler attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank, much of which Abbas's government governs and which is considered the heart of any future Palestinian state. Abbas and other Palestinian officials could not travel to New York, however, because since the end of July, the Trump administration has sanctioned the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, alleging they support terrorism. Abbas used his video address to call for an end to Israel's war in Gaza and for a future Palestinian state free of Hamas. Emily Fang, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
U.S. stock indexes stumbled for the third straight day, giving up more of the big gains made so far this year. The S&P 500 fell 0.5%. This is NPR News from Washington. A Paris court has sentenced former French President Nicolas Sarkozy to 5 years in prison for criminal conspiracy. He was found guilty of attempting to finance his 2007 campaign with funds from Libya. Sarkozy is 70 years old and will go to prison even if he appeals. He denounced today's ruling as a scandalous injustice. Officials in Mississippi are worried about the state's babies. The state recently declared a public health crisis around infant mortalities. NPR's Katie Riddle reports.
One significant factor in the crisis here, lack of insurance. The state has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act the way other states have. Obstetrician Lakeisha Richardson says without insurance, her patients often get to her when it's too late.
They're showing up with severe preeclampsia and they're not stable for transfer, but also they're showing up in in ways or things with preterm labor or complicated medical diagnosis that we could have prevented.
Richardson is part of a public health team working to reduce infant deaths throughout the state. Katie Riddle, NPR News, the Mississippi Delta.
Crabs, worms, and fish are thriving on discarded World War II explosives in the Baltic Sea, thought to be toxic to marine life. At a former weapons dump site off the coast of Germany, scientists found more creatures living on top of warheads than in surrounding seabed. Researchers filmed networks of anemones, starfish, and other underwater life. They hope to calculate how much contamination was absorbed by sea life. The work is detailed in the Journal of Communications, Earth and Environment. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. Weather tonight, clear skies with lows 44 to 49 degrees, northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny with temps in the low mid-70s.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Amazon and the federal government reached an historic settlement today in a case about Amazon's popular Prime subscription service. The Federal Trade Commission announced the $2.5 billion settlement 2 days after the trial kicked off in Seattle. This could change how retailers sell things online. Monica Nicholsberg of member station KUOW in Seattle was in the courtroom. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, I'll note Amazon is among NPR's financial supporters, but we cover them like any other company. Then let me note, $2.5 billion is a lot of money. Tell us the details of the settlement.
It is. The FTC says this is the second largest consumer redress in its history. So of the $2.5 billion, $1 billion will be civil penalties to the government. But the remaining $1.5 billion will be payments directly to Amazon customers who used Prime benefits during these years that the government says Amazon broke the law. Now, Prime is a huge program, and with this settlement, millions of eligible Prime members will automatically get payments of $51 each.
So the government says Amazon broke the law. How exactly?
Well, the case comes out of this years-long investigation that found Amazon allegedly used manipulative design to trick millions of people into subscribing to Prime. The FTC's complaint also claims that Amazon created this long, intentionally complicated process to unsubscribe from Prime that was codenamed the Iliad Flow.
Did it have anything to do with the epic Greek poem by Homer?
I think it's a fair assumption. Designs like this that get a user to do something that they didn't mean to do, they're sometimes called dark patterns, which in this case, the government was trying to prove are a type of fraud.
I have never heard of a dark pattern. What does that look like?
Well, in the lawsuit, for example, the FTC highlighted this page that would pop up on Amazon when a customer was trying to buy something. It had this big yellow button that said something like, get fast free shipping, next to a tiny little link that said, no thanks, I don't want fast free shipping. The FTC claimed that customers didn't realize that by clicking that yellow button, they were signing up for Prime.
Okay, why do you think Amazon agreed to this huge settlement?
Well, we should note, Amazon doesn't admit any wrongdoing as part of this settlement. The company said that the deal just allows it to move forward and focus on its customers. And Amazon says that the changes that the settlement is making them enact, or they were already in place. They had already done those changes, so it wasn't a huge deal. But sitting in the courtroom yesterday, it's kind of hard not to feel like the way the trial was going had something to do with it.
How is the trial going?
Well, yesterday, the FTC called its key witness. He's a former user experience designer for Amazon. His name is Reed Nelson, and he spent a decade with the company. His testimony showed that he and his team had repeatedly flagged this common customer frustration that a lot of people were being signed up for Prime when they just thought that they were checking out. Nelson said that Amazon experimented with making that little no thanks link clearer and easier to find, but then backpedaled when Prime subscriber numbers took a hit.
So what does this all mean for the future of online shopping?
Well, Amazon kind of sets the tone for the industry. So the fact that the government got this large settlement, I think it does send a message, especially because the FTC was trying to prove that Prime fell under this law that sets the rules of the road for disclosure and transparency online. It's called the Restore Online Shoppers Confidence Act. And the final ruling says that that law does apply. So I think this settlement could cause other retailers to think twice about using these so-called dark patterns.
That is Monica Nicholsberg of KUOW in Seattle. Thank you.
Thank you.
For years, acetaminophen, known in the U.S. by its popular brand name Tylenol, has been considered completely safe for use during pregnancy, a time when doctors discourage patients from using many other medications. This week, the Trump administration announced that they would be changing the label to discourage its use by pregnant women, suggesting that there is a link between acetaminophen and autism. That announcement has led to confusion, alarm, and many questions, so many questions, especially from expecting parents. So here to help us sort through some of that confusion is Dr. Noah Sterling. She's a board-certified OBGYN who advises expectant parents through her app, Sterling Parents. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. So I'm so curious, what kinds of questions have you been fielding this week since this announcement?
A lot of people who have taken Tylenol in their pregnancy, still currently pregnant, freaking out, as you can imagine. And then a lot of people also who have children who have been diagnosed as autism spectrum disorder and are wondering if their Tylenol use in pregnancy caused this.
Okay, well, let's talk about what we actually know, the facts. Tylenol has been widely used for decades. What does the science actually say about its safety during pregnancy?
Yeah, so the science tells us a number of things. Number one, we know that the use of acetaminophen for fever in the first trimester is associated with a reduced risk of birth defects. So we know that it has that benefit. We also know that there are some studies that show an association between acetaminophen use in pregnancy and autism spectrum disorder and ADHD. This is an association, not causation. And there's mixed data here. So there are some studies that show a positive relationship, that Tylenol use is associated positively with autism spectrum disorder. And then there's some studies that show no impact and some studies that show a negative impact.
Okay. What if you have a fever during your pregnancy? I mean, one big reason people take Tylenol is to bring down a fever. So can you just explain why can a fever be potentially quite dangerous during pregnancy if left untreated?
Exactly. So it's specifically during a period we call embryogenesis. So that happens during the first trimester of pregnancy. And during that time period, elevated core body temperature is associated with birth defects. So we really do want patients, when they have a fever, they have an elevated temperature above 100.4, to take acetaminophen to bring that fever down. However, treating a fever later on in pregnancy is really for symptom control. It's not as necessary because fevers later on in pregnancy do not cause congenital anomalies.
Well, in the meantime, given this latest announcement from the Trump administration, I'm just wondering what pregnant women should be doing, because President Trump's advice to pregnant women is essentially, quote, tough it out and avoid Tylenol for any reason. Is that something you would recommend?
No, I'm very upset by that terminology of tough it out, because pregnancy is incredibly difficult, even for people who have healthy pregnancies. Pregnant women and individuals are already toughing out a lot. So we really have to look at the entire clinical picture. We know that it's important for acetaminophen to be used judiciously, especially in the first trimester. We want people to use it to bring down fever. Now, later on in pregnancy, when fever is not as much of a concern, it still is the first line, the really only available medication that we have to treat pain. And the important thing is we really have to look at the entire clinical picture. An example is a lot of people will take acetaminophen in pregnancy because of back pain or hip pain that is preventing them from sleeping. Yeah. We know that disruption of sleep in pregnancy is associated with numerous complications. So we don't want to just say no acetaminophen ever. What we want to do is have a shared decision-making with your healthcare provider so that you together can weigh the risks and benefits of taking acetaminophen in pregnancy.
Dr. Noah Sterling is an OBGYN in San Diego and founder of Sterling Parents, an app providing pregnancy and postpartum support. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me and having this important discussion.
The Billboard charts have not been too kind to rock and roll music in 2025, but this week's number one album reminds us that rock isn't dead. NPR's Stephen Thompson has the story.
Most weeks, if you scan the main Billboard charts, you'll see a ton of pop, hip-hop, K-pop, R&B, and country music. Rock and roll turns up less often, usually in the form of greatest hits compilations and classic albums like Nirvana's Nevermind. But new rock records do still find their way to the top of the charts. Just this year, two different masked rock bands have topped the Billboard Albums chart. There's the Swedish band Ghost, whose members combine theatrical costuming with towering rock. Then there's the UK group Sleep Token, whose prog metal songs are performed by musicians who hide their identity behind masks. This week, another rock band hits the top of the charts, albeit without costumes. The group 21 Pilots, which last topped the album's chart in 2015, has the country's number one album with Breach. Twenty One Pilots have won a Grammy and spawned major pop hits over the years, including a handful that have hit the top five with a mix of rock, hip-hop, and nervy pop music. But Breach leans farther than ever into stormy, high-concept prog rock with nods to hip-hop along the way. Square up with me, I can come to you. Tell me when. Pair up with me, I can run on you. 21 Pilots' new album hasn't produced any major pop hits. Only one of the band's songs cracks this week's Hot 100 singles chart as City Walls debuts at number 83. But the group does have one major thing going for it: physical record sales. Breach sold 169,000 copies its first week, with 72,000 of them released through a format as classic as rock and roll itself, vinyl. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234.
On today's date, September 25th, 1991, my wife Denise reports hearing the call of a saw-whet owl. You don't often hear saw-whet owls calling in the fall. They are primarily late March, early April singers in the spring, as they return from their migration. What my wife was hearing was a migrating saw-whet owl. Few of us are ever aware of their migration because they do it at night, and they do it very carefully and cautiously and without a lot of fanfare. There are no great flocks of saw-whet owls flying south. Rather, a steady wave of them moving through our area. And there are a lot of saw-whet owls, way more than you might suspect. And it is very unusual for you to find them in the fall as they're migrating. But there was a fellow up in the Big Fork area for several years who caught, trapped, and banded the saw-whet owls. And his numbers indicate a huge migration every fall. He had One night, 43 birds that he trapped and banded in that evening. So whether you realize it or not, this is the time of year when the saw-whet owls are sneaking past your home.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from Mathnasium, whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build skills and confidence through personalized math instruction to help students achieve their potential this school year. Learn more at mathnasium.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth has summoned the top U.S. military brass from across the globe to a meeting in Virginia next week. And that's most of what we know. We have a little word on why the highly unusual meeting has been called. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is here in the studio. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Ari.
What more can you tell us about this meeting?
Well, not a lot. We're talking hundreds of generals and admirals who will meet on Tuesday at Marine Base Quantico, just south of Washington. The Washington Post was first to report on this meeting, and NPR confirmed it with a source not authorized to speak. And we later got a statement from Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell saying, quote, the Secretary of War will be addressing his senior military leaders early next week. And he was using the term Secretary of War, which both President Trump and Defense Secretary Hegseth prefer instead of Defense Secretary.
In all the years you've covered the military, do you recall any meeting of this scale like this?
No, nothing like this. I've never heard of anything on this scale. At times they'll bring in, let's say, combatant commanders, those who oversee military operations around the world, bring them to the Pentagon for annual meetings, but this is far different in the numbers. Now, Secretary Hegseth has talked about reducing the number of admirals and generals who stand at more than 800, reducing that number by 20%. And he talked about that during his confirmation hearing earlier this year, and also put out a video statement back in May, once again referring to this. Let's listen.
We're back with more DOD reforms. This one is General and Flag Officer Reductions. That's the official title. My title is Less Generals, More GIs. It's a historic one, and it's in keeping with President Trump's commitment to achieving peace through strength. We're going to shift resources from bloated headquarters elements to our warfighters.
So again, this meeting could focus on that issue, but we really don't know.
Well, in addition to cutting back the number of admirals and generals, Secretary Hegseth has talked broadly about refashioning U.S. military culture. How has that played out so far?
Right. He said he wants to return to what he calls a warrior ethos. Although those who I travel with over the years in Iraq and Afghanistan, they say, hey, listen, we've always had a warrior ethos. He has pushed for removing any diversity, equity, inclusiveness, removing those who say are pushing that agenda. He'll remove some 4,000 transgender troops, saying they're not compatible with military service. And he's also preparing for tougher physical fitness standards for troops.
The Pentagon is also moving to implement a new media policy. Tell us about that.
Well, it says reporters must pledge not to support a report on classified or even unclassified material until something is released by the Pentagon. If you don't agree to this, you'll lose your press pass, and you can't report from the Pentagon, but also, Ari, you'll be barred from any U.S. military base around the world. Well, as you know, our job is not to be stenographers. The Pentagon has public affairs people and service members who write news stories. What we do is find out what's going on behind the scenes. What are the policies? Are they working? What weapons are you buying? Are you wasting money, involved in illegal activity? We're basically the watchdogs of government.
How unusual is that kind of a media policy, given your years of experience covering the Pentagon?
Well, there was a time we could roam around the Pentagon, maybe run into admirals and generals, get a better sense of what's going on, you know, the nuance of what's happening. I remember after Baghdad fell during the Iraq War, Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld talked about the success of Baghdad falling in his briefing. And after that, I was walking down the hall and ran into this Army officer. I said, hey, good news, right? He said, Tom, this is not a success. Saddam Hussein supporters are hitting our supply lines. We have to send troops back to protect them, because Rumsfeld never sent enough troops. That was an important development. Ari, now I'm not allowed to walk down that hallway.
That is NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Thank you.
You're welcome.
President Trump has announced a deal on TikTok. The president signed an executive order today declaring that a group of American investors are set to take over the app's U.S. operations. For more on this deal and how it could change TikTok, we're joined now by NPR's Bobby Allen. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, what's up, Elsa?
Hey, okay, so the president, I mean, he's been promising a deal on TikTok for months now, like basically since before he was even inaugurated. So what was actually unveiled today?
Yeah, the big news is that Trump says TikTok now complies with federal law. He revealed a group of American investors who are going to pool their money together and take over TikTok's U.S. operations, as you mentioned. And this group includes Michael Dell, the Murdoch family, and software and cloud infrastructure company Oracle, which is going to have a huge role here. Oracle will be managing the security of Americans' data. Oracle's going to oversee how the algorithm is pushing videos to people. The idea also is that, you know, Oracle can keep out any possible Chinese influence. But China here is not totally out of the picture, right? Beijing-based ByteDance is expected to have just under 20% of U.S. TikTok, and TikTok will be using an algorithm developed by ByteDance. But a version of it is set to be licensed specifically for American users. So people hearing this who are on TikTok, look, you won't have to download a new app. These changes are going to happen in the background, and honestly, you probably won't notice them. Here's Vice President Vance talking about the deal just a little bit ago from the Oval Office.
The U.S. company will have control over how the algorithm pushes content to users, and that was a very important part of it. We thought it was necessary for the national security element of the law. We also just think it's important to protect American users.
Wait, let me just make sure I understand this, Bobby. TikTok's app in the U.S. will have new owners, okay? So does this really solve the main concerns with the app? Like, could this app be a possible tool for Chinese influence over Americans?
Yeah, so the big fear with TikTok has always been China. TikTok, as we know, is owned by ByteDance in Beijing, and many have been concerned for a long time that that meant that, you know, TikTok might push videos that favor China's view of the world, that the app could be used as some kind of surveillance tool, you know, to spy on Americans. Now, there is no public evidence that either of these things have ever come to pass, but that fear alone was enough to motivate Congress to pass a law that essentially said, look, TikTok, you either cut ties with China or you're totally banned in the U.S. That law has been extended a number of times now by President Trump. And now the White House is saying, we have a plan now that does establish a firewall between the U.S. and China. Chinese influence will be kept out. But this is really up for debate, especially since ByteDance is going to maintain a stake of the app and the algorithm it's using is still owned by ByteDance.
Yeah. Okay, well, you mentioned Oracle will have a big role here. What is Oracle getting from this deal, you think?
Money and influence. Uh-huh. Even before this deal, Oracle brought on TikTok as one of their biggest customers for cloud data storage. So that kind of set the stage on a technical level. But the politics here really matter, Elsa. Larry Ellison is Oracle's co-founder, has been a close ally of President Trump, and has been really ingratiating himself with the president in recent months. And now it looks like he has been rewarded with a huge stake in TikTok, which is quite the prize. I mean, the app is used by more than half of America. A new survey came out today showing that a fifth of adults now get their news on TikTok, so it is quite influential. And it's just the latest win for the Ellison family media empire. Larry Ellison's son, David, now runs Paramount and CBS and is now looking at a possible CNN parent company bid. So look, having sway over TikTok only extends the Ellison family's reach into more America media and entertainment.
So interesting. That is NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks, Elsa.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration is instructing federal agencies to prepare for mass firings if the government shuts down on October 1st. And these job layoffs would likely come from programs that do not align with the administration's priorities. That story and a lot more coming up tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pokegama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs, bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.org. This weekend on Stay Human, live storytelling from last week's Authentic Voice event, Lauren Neamey takes his life in his hands, Teresa Alto goes to the county jail, and Michael Goldberg almost makes it to the fabulous island of Crete. Story and song for spirit and courage, Saturday morning at 9, Sunday at 5 p.m. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library have their big fall book sale, October 1st through the 3rd, at Westgate Mall from 10 to 6 each day. Now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A resource guide to help small and medium-sized governments in the Great Lakes region adapt to climate change has been published. Chuck Kornbach reports that some tribal communities in the area are already trying to reduce problems caused by higher temperatures and additional flooding.
The guide is from the International Joint Commission, or IJC, which helps implement the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909 between the U.S. and Canada. Liz Kirkwood of the IJC's Water Quality Board says climate change has brought more severe storms, loss of ice cover, and extreme temperatures to much of North America, including the Great Lakes region.
In 2024, extreme weather disasters cost the eight Great Lakes states more than $13 billion U.S. dollars combined. Some of the costliest disasters happened in the last 5 years.
While debate continues over how to reduce air pollution that contributes to climate change, the IJC has published a guide aimed at helping small and medium-sized governments adapt to the new temperatures and heavier rainfalls. Charlie Rasmussen of the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission says his organization welcomes the sharing of best practices, funding ideas, and other strategies. He says the commission's 11 Ojibwe member tribes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota are already taking steps, sometimes in collaboration with local, state, or federal agencies. One project being Ishkade. That's using prescribed or controlled fires on land next to water.
They help maintain and reestablish native species that do the best job at holding the soil and able to resist, you know, some of these severe precipitation events.
Rasmussen says other tribes are putting in larger roadside culverts to reduce highway damage from flooding and to help wildlife move. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
This academic year in North Dakota, eighth graders are getting new textbooks that'll educate them about the five tribes that are found within the state. As Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports, this is a series that's being revised for the first time in 30 years.
Originally, four texts and a journal were printed between 1995 and 2002. Much of the content came from interviews with tribal elders in the 1970s. This new series will still feature books on the Spirit Lake Oyate, Standing Rock Oyate, Turtle Mountain Ojibwe, and the three affiliated tribes or Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, or MHA. But a new edition on the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate has been added, and each tribe had exclusive editorial control over their respective book, which included more recent historical information.
It's so important that Indigenous peoples are represented in a contemporary sense.
Sashay Shetler is an MHA citizen and the assistant director of North Dakota's Office of Indigenous and Multicultural Education. She recalls classmates growing up who thought Native people were extinct.
And then you have people getting elected into positions, and if you have somebody thinking that Indigenous peoples don't exist, they're going to make policies that aren't bettering our communities for everyone.
5% of North Dakota's population is Native American. Nick Asbury is a former employee of the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction who has remained active in promoting the books.
It's important that we have the platform for the nations to tell their own story because kids are smart. They know when something is authentic and when it's not.
An original overview entitled Journey to Understanding, An Introduction to North Dakota Tribes, is still part of the set. Besides eighth graders, people can download the set for free or order a published copy online. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Now.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Now more than ever, the supporters of this and all Native One programs deserve a little extra love. Learn more about all our public radio underwriters and web-based sponsors at kawanak.org/supporters-spotlight.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Property tax. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In the last week, many countries have taken a step that Palestinians have wanted for decades.
The United Kingdom formally recognizes the state of Palestine.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said he was acting, quote, to revive the hope of peace and a two-state solution. French President Emmanuel Macron echoed that message, speaking at the UN through an interpreter.
We must do everything within our power to preserve the very possibility of a two-state solution.
Several other European countries have also recently recognized Palestine. So have Canada and Australia. To talk about whether this step can make a meaningful difference in the lives of Palestinians, Rutgers professor Noura Erekat is with us. She's a human rights attorney and author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What does international recognition of Palestine actually mean in practical terms for Palestinian people today?
International recognition under international law means very little, especially for Palestinians who in 2012 were recognized by a majority of the General Assembly to be non-voting members of the United Nations. So international recognition at this stage actually means less than symbolism, because those very states, one, are late to recognize Palestine per their legal obligations, but also they're doing it at a time when they're continuing to support Israel's genocide through the provision of arms and cover. For example, the UK is one of the most significant weapons providers to Israel, and they should be imposing an arms embargo at this moment. France, for its part, has said that it won't recognize necessarily the arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu by the ICC and has provided him airspace to fly over it. So at the same time that these countries are late to the game to recognize Palestine as a state, they're also part and parcel of the problem that continues to remove Palestinians from their lands in order for settlers to be able to take their place.
Let me just recognize you referred to genocide. It's a legal term. While Israel has been accused, it has not been convicted. And also you mentioned the ICC. I want to note that's the International Criminal Court. You said that this is less than symbolism, that it is not going to have a positive impact. Could it have a negative impact? Because Israel has reacted with anger, saying that there has to be immediate countermeasures. National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has talked about possibly annexing the occupied West Bank. Do you think this could ultimately create a backlash that leaves Palestinian people worse off?
Let me start by saying that I do think the one positive thing that comes out of this is that for the first time we're seeing European nations, you know, coalesce, consolidate their efforts in order to confront longstanding U.S. policy, which is to provide unequivocal support to Israel in its systematic human rights abuses and crimes against humanity against the Palestinians. The negative effects that you indicate, which is the backlash by Israel, should really concern everybody, that Israel is responding to its crimes that it's committing, the war crimes, crimes against humanity on the ground. You say alleged genocide, but many scholars and institutions have said that it was genocide, have responded to that by promising to commit more crimes through the annexation of the West Bank, which is the acquisition of territory by force. And so here we have exactly what the problem is, which is a context in which Israel has been able to act with impunity. And rather than respond to this moment of international mobilization, has basically told the international community, we're going to do even more and even worse, and there's nothing that you can do about it.
You expressed this hope that Europe speaking loudly with one voice, along with other countries like Australia and Canada, can build momentum to some positive outcome for Palestinians. Can that happen as long as the U.S. remains a strong supporter of Israel, even if Israel and the U.S. become more isolated on the international stage? Can there be meaningful change for the lives of Palestinians as long as the U.S. continues to allow the Israeli government a free hand?
The U.S. is certainly the primary obstacle to an outcome, to a multilateral outcome and an international resolution to the Palestinian condition of unfreedom. But the U.S. was also the last domino to fall when it came to protecting apartheid South Africa. So we have seen in the past that though the U.S. may be the primary objector, it isn't necessarily going to be the final determinant of whether or not a people are able to prevail in their liberation struggle.
In the introduction, we heard European leaders say one reason they chose to recognize a Palestinian state is in order to protect the possibility of a two-state solution. Given the facts on the ground right now, from the devastation in Gaza to the expansion of settlements in the occupied West Bank, do you think there is still a path to that outcome?
Ari, you know, I think the two-state solution as a label is so misleading because Israel has been admitted into the United Nations as a state since 1948. The Palestinian Liberation Organization recognized Israel in 1993. So when we say two-state solution, you're basically saying, is it possible to establish a Palestinian state? But for Palestinians, that possibility is setting us up to live in a police state without sovereignty. It's another way of encaging Palestinians where we will be overseen by a Palestinian police force that is beholden to Israeli interests. We will be forced to demilitarize and not allowed to have a state where we can even exercise our own electoral agenda. So not only on the ground do we have our land that has been made non-contiguous and settled by settlers, but also in the configuration that's planned in the New York Declaration, we will not have meaningful sovereignty. At this point, those states that want to preserve anything should preserve their legitimacy, should preserve the international order and human rights by abiding by the ICJ decision that said not to recognize Israel's unlawful presence in the occupied territories, which means boycott, divestment, sanctions, which means abiding by the ICJ decision that said that there is plausible genocide, which imposes upon them a duty to prevent genocide, not merely to punish, meaning right now they should be imposing an arms embargo. There's many ways that the international community can act rather than distracting us in this moment and not offering Palestinians the liberation that they deserve, that they need, that all people need, not to set a precedent here in Palestine that can be replicated elsewhere.
We've been speaking to you as a professor, a scholar, an author, a human rights lawyer, but as a Palestinian, as a Palestinian American, how do you feel seeing these world leaders say, we recognize the state of Palestine?
As a Palestinian, my heart is very broken that a genocide can continue, that Palestinian babies can be slaughtered, and there is a debate over whether or not that's okay or how it should be done better. As a Palestinian, I'm so frustrated that rather than take aim at the oppressive systems that place us in these conditions, like prolonged military occupation, apartheid, and genocide, that we are made into a problem to be resolved. We are not the problem. These conditions that oppress us are the problem and should be what the international community targets to destroy rather than allowing us to be the target of destruction.
Professor Noura Erekat of Rutgers is author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, Ari.
And just for a bit more context on the genocide question, Israel strongly rejects accusations that it has committed genocide or crimes against humanity in Gaza. It says it is fighting a war of self-defense against Hamas. And yet earlier this month, a UN commission of inquiry found Israel had committed genocide in Gaza.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, along with the Cass and Crow Wing Soil and Water Conservation Districts, have a Smart Salting for Road certification course Wednesday, October 8th from 8 to 1:30 in Bacchus. Learn how to maintain safe roads while reducing environmental impacts. The training is free, but registration is required by October 1st. Text KAXE for more information at 218-326-1234. The Brainerd's Lake Area Walk to End Alzheimer's is Saturday, September 27th at Forest View Middle School in Baxter. Registration begins at 9 a.m. with a ceremony and walk at 10. Cross Lake Days are now through Saturday, September 27th with an arts and crafts fair, live music, cornhole tournament, and more. Find a full schedule at crosslake.com.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's broadcast, important new information for 23andMe customers. Then, automatic license plate readers prompt concerns about how data is used in North Central Minnesota. And why blue and green bows are appearing throughout the Twin Cities. I'm Chantel Sings. Minnesotans affected by the bankruptcy of genetic testing company 23andMe have a new way to protect their data. As part of its bankruptcy proceedings, 23andMe, through a bidding process, arranged an equity sale and sold the company to TTAM Research Institute, a California nonprofit. The Minnesota Attorney General's Office, along with the Coalition of Attorney Generals, secured consumer protections, including a privacy ombudsman, annual audits, and the right for consumers to permanently delete their data. Consumers must log in to 23andMe to permanently delete their data. Next, after the placement of automatic license plate readers in the north central part of the state, some civil liberties groups are concerned about how the data is going to be managed. Victor Palomino talks with the news director of Amper Station KAXE about this and other issues in north central Minnesota.
Local authorities set up 12 automatic license plate readers in the Bemidji area and other cities in north central Minnesota as part of a program to monitor crime. But KAXE news director Chelsea Perkins said that some privacy advocates have raised concerns about it.
In this case, the Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force sought some grant funding to put up these cameras so that they could keep track of any potential drug activity in the area, and with the side effect of also helping out with any other crimes that may take place.
The cameras are run by the company Flux Safety. Recently, the Illinois government found out that this company was allowing federal agencies and other out-state agencies to use some of the data that had been collected.
There certainly has been some conversations on social media with people raising concerns about these. There is also a website that's called DFlock that tracks the locations of these cameras. And, you know, they cite the fact that, for instance, a law enforcement officer at one time used it to track his estranged wife.
Chelsea added that the Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force says that it will not hold the data for more than 30 days unless it's part of an active investigation they are conducting. And the state laws require auditing to be done every 2 years.
So there are definitely reasons why people are concerned. But again, local authorities, you know, have insisted that there's no reason for people in this part of the state to be concerned and that they plan to, you know, take care with the use of these devices.
In other news, the north central part of the state is expanding its public transit.
Well, Go Marty is a free autonomous transit system that is in Itasca County, and it's based in Grand Rapids. It's been in use for a few years now, but recently, just in early September, they expanded, and they now have more 60 new stops in Cohasset, Deer River, and Ball Club, which includes areas of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Reservation.
The expansion is now providing access to people with disability issues, and riders can request a ride with the Go Marty app.
And it's especially important in communities like those in the reservation, where there are certainly some challenges to access to transportation.
The program is also a spotlight for the region.
So it's, you know, unique as well in the fact that it's actually one of the only such projects in the whole world that is testing this type of transit in an area where there's snow and cold to contend with.
To listen to all the news from the North Central region, visit kaxe.org. For North Star Stories, I'm Victor Palomino.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Blue and green ribbons are starting to line even more streets throughout the Twin Cities. It's an effort to draw attention to the victims of the Annunciation Church and school shooting. North Star Stories spotted a volunteer recently putting the bows up along Mississippi River Boulevard in St. Paul. It's all part of the Bows of Love project. The Bows of Love website says the project is a volunteer-driven movement fueled by a shared belief in community connection and support. You can find more information about the project online at bowsoflove.com.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The state of Mississippi recently declared a public health emergency on an issue that is tragic for many families, infant mortality. The state has some of the highest rates in the nation. NPR's Katie Riddle brings us this report on the fight to save Mississippi's babies.
Things were not looking good from Dr. Daniel Edney's perspective as last year's data collection was coming to an end. He's the public health officer in Mississippi. It's his job to closely track the infant mortality rate.
It just kept climbing because we get another death coming in, another death coming in.
Edney remembers exactly where he was when he got the final figures, sitting at his desk chair in his office.
My vital records team came to me and just said, we just need to give you a heads up. It's not looking good.
In fact, he said it was very bad. For context, the infant mortality rate across the U.S. is 5.6 for every 1,000 live births. That means for every 1,000 babies born, 5 or 6 die. In Mississippi in 2024, it was nearly 10. For black babies, even worse, at 15.2.
If having babies dying at the rate that our babies are dying is not a public health emergency, I don't know what is.
That allowed him to expedite a strategy that he and his team were already building. A critical piece of it is here, in a town called Hattiesburg, at the NICU in Forest General Hospital. Randy Henderson, a neonatologist, gives a tour.
This is the intensive side over here, so these are the sicker babies and the smaller babies here.
Complications from early birth is a significant reason that infants are dying here. Henderson reads from a sign on the door of a room in his hospital. Inside is one of his tiny patients.
2 pounds, 5 ounces, and the height was 12 inches.
So 2 pounds, 5 ounces at birth, that's very small.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Is that typical?
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, we have a lot of babies this size. We get a lot smaller than 2 pounds.
Wow, really? How small? What's the smallest?
Less than a pound. Yeah, for sure.
This little baby boy is in an incubator. Two nurses are attending to him. He's hooked up to a lot of tubes.
This little one has a central line in the leg that we're using to give liquid nutrition.
There are only a few facilities like this in the state. Henderson is part of a team of doctors and public health officials trying to improve access to places like this so that premature babies can get a high level of care from the moment they are born.
So this baby's on something called bubble CPAP, which just helps with the breathing.
In recent decades, medicine has made huge strides in saving the lives of premature babies. One big advancement is the development of something called surfactant. That's a soapy substance that is produced in the lungs. It's critical to helping people breathe. Premature babies don't always make it on their own. Now doctors can give it to them. That's if they have it.
Some of the outside hospitals don't have surfactant, so it's not an option. And some of the doctors don't know how to put a breathing tube in if the baby needs it.
By getting moms into these specialty facilities sooner, their babies have a better chance of surviving. But there's a bigger issue that this team is not able to address.
If you can get a mom healthy before she's pregnant, that is your best opportunity to prevent a preterm birth.
Anita Henderson is a pediatrician here. She's married to Randy Henderson, the neonatologist. Anita Henderson says that many of the conditions that contribute to premature birth are chronic, like diabetes or hypertension. Aside from saving lives, she says, treating these conditions in advance of pregnancy would save money.
Investing in moms now will prevent long-term complications, prevent those million-dollar NICU babies.
This is the root of the problem. More than half the counties in Mississippi are considered maternity health care deserts, where mothers can't get comprehensive prenatal health care. Mississippi did not expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act like many other states. And the recent budget passed by the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress is cutting Medicaid by almost $1 trillion over the next decade.
In Mississippi, all across the nation, we're really just trying to keep what we have. we know that we have huge Medicaid cuts that are coming down the pike.
Nationally, advocates worry that as people lose access to Medicaid over the next few years, infant mortality will get even worse, not just in Mississippi. Michael Warren is with the March of Dimes. The group advocates for improvements in maternal health care across the country. He calls the U.S. one of the most dangerous developed countries for giving birth, with more than five babies dying per 1,000 births.
What that translates to is 20,000 deaths every year. That's the equivalent of a jumbo jet crashing once a week for an entire year and killing everyone on board.
20,000 people, he says, who had not reached their first birthday.
And let's be realistic for a minute. If that happened in this country, we'd stop flying after a couple of weeks. There would be task forces. There would be investigations. We would say we've got to get to the bottom of this.
Warren says while he applauds the work that Mississippi is doing, he insists we should be asking the same of every state in the country. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
There is an annual tradition in Wilmington, North Carolina, called the Pooch Plunge. It's where the city invites dogs to its public pool before that pool is drained for the winter. Kelly Kenoyer from member station WHQR sniffed it out.
On a recent Sunday in September, about 80 dogs run loose in and around the Legion Stadium pool, chasing dozens and dozens of tennis balls and each other.
This is just the absolute craziest weekend.
That's Lindsay Hayes, the director of aquatic safety. She says the annual Pooch Plunge is also a big fundraiser with about 600 dogs and an entry fee of just $5 a tail.
We usually make more money in these 2 or 3 days than we do in a whole month.
Good, you did it!
The vast majority here are water dogs, retrievers and Labradors galore, with doodles in a close third place. I spot the biggest dog here, a lion-like mane and enormous jowls. He's a Leonberger named Moselle, who's surprisingly dry. Warren Brenneman owns this 120-pound dog.
He's a sweetheart. Loves all dogs, scared of people, and scared of the water.
So why bring him to the Pooch Plunge?
Because I'm hoping he swims. They have webbed feet.
He says his last dog was a Leonberger who loved to swim. But Mo, not so much. Across the pool is Floki, the smallest dog here, a little white West Highland Terrier who is soaked. His owner, Tracy Clary, says he has a typical Westie personality.
Very confident. He's a big dog in a little body.
But they're not natural swimmers.
He accidentally went in and was going after the ball and he couldn't stop in time, so.
Clary brought Floki here to join her son and his Labrador, who is happily leaping into the pool, no hesitation. She says she came here for more than just fetch. She loves watching the chaos.
They all just get along. I mean, all these dogs are just having a great time. Big dogs, little dogs, every color dog.
All kinds of dogs, taking advantage of their one chance a year to visit the public pool. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Kenoyer in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at ColeraineBank.com, member FDIC. Greater Lakes Area Performing Arts and Pequot Lakes Community Theater present Annie now through September 28th at Pequot Lakes High School Theater. Thursday and Saturday shows are at 7, with a Sunday matinee at 2. Weather tonight, clear skies with lows 44 to 49 degrees, northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny with temps in the low mid-70s, southeast winds 5 to 10, gusts getting up to 15, overnight temps 50 to 55. Saturday, sunny with highs in the upper 60s, low 70s.
This is, at best, a negotiating tactic.